Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I'm Terry Foyt, joined this time by Kyle Devitt, and we are shifting gears a little bit for you on a Wednesday. For the last month or so, Wednesday has been about Division I fall ball and true fall ball lacrosse. But because this weekend boasted some relatively unusual events, Kyle and I are going to be discussing a lot of international lacrosse, specifically the U.S. men's national team, which was in action on Saturday versus the University of Maryland, defending Division I NCAA champions, and then on Sunday against Towson. I was on hand Sunday for the U.S. team's 22-2 victory over Towson, and Kyle watched the live stream of the U.S. team's dramatic 10-9 victory over Maryland. Kyle, thank you for joining us. What was your impression of that game?
It was like watching a sports car like drag race against like a souped up, like, I don't know, like something from a Fast and Furious movie, but the race car had a handbrake on, and that's why it was close, because otherwise the race car would have won.
And so do you attribute that to, I mean, the best place to start, I think, talking about US team is to talk about the coaching staff, because clearly they set the tone for everything. You know, these are the best players in the world that, for the first time in a long time, are in the position of quote unquote being coached. I remember, you know, talking about the tryout process with Matt Strebel over the summer ahead of the actual tryout in July. His comment was the experience going through the process in 2010 felt like work for the first time. I believe he said this. Maybe it was Kyle Harrison talking about the 2014 experience, but it felt like work. Like college lacrosse was work for the first time since college, but in a good way. And that resonates with me because of the power that this coaching staff holds. What was your impression? And then we'll dive into some of the specifics about the staff.
I don't think they cared at all about the final result. And I put that down to they put out a squad that was an offense that was made to hold the ball, handle the ball, and look for layups instead of mid-range shots or drives from X or even easy offense. Like anything transition was pretty much off limits for this group. And I think that's just a function of, you know, the boogeyman. The boogeyman is Canada, and you want to beat the boogeyman. And Team USA knows that. They know that. They know they're going to get, you know, 5 to 10 easy goals against a lot of teams in transition based solely on the offensive talent on the roster, no matter who gets picked at this point. Do you agree with that point, at least in part?
In part, yes. I think that I don't want to – I think it's important to say that, like, I'm not attaching judgment to the idea of building a roster to beat Canada, because that's – what the goal is, right? Like, for a lot of teams, it's to win the tournament. For the United States, it's to beat Canada, because that goes hand in hand with winning the tournament. So I think because of the uniqueness of international rules and the familiarity with both professional lacrosse players, Team Canada, and the international rules, it makes sense that this staff would be very intentional. And so diving into the specifics, the head coach is John Danowski. The assistants are Joe Amplo, who is, to my understanding, handling the defense, and Seth Tierney, who, to my understanding, is handling the offense, and Tony Resch, who, like, you know, he's got the most experience at the pro level, he's got the most experience in the indoor game, coaching at least, and then he has the most experience preparing for Team Canada, particularly having been a part of that staff in 2010. And so my sense is that he's kind of the glue guy that kind of brings everything together. They have a group of roughly 47 players. Teams were divided in half. The white roster took on Towson on Sunday. The blue roster took on Maryland on Saturday. And to your point, you know, you saw a team that felt like it was being very intentional about the way that it was trying to approach the offensive end of the field. you know, my interpretation for that is because the majority of the players that they expect to make this team from at the offensive end of the field played on Saturday night, whereas the majority of players that they expect to make this team at the defensive end of the field played on Sunday. That was my kind of general observation, takeaway, you know, based on preconceived notions, networks, connections, etc. Certainly not based on any type of anecdotal feedback. And so to your point about, you know, slow playing transition, so to speak, or avoiding transition, my sense was on Sunday was just a strangle. And I really thought that it was, you know, Towson was sloppy and they turned the ball over a lot. But I felt like there was an emphasis on when Towson did get possession, which was not very often because they only won 3 of 26 faceoffs. They were really limited in the interior looks, and they were really pressured, particularly at X, to not get comfortable. And I think that that was part of why they turned the ball over with such high frequency.
So let me ask you about the goaltender situation, because if your theory holds water, which I believe it does, I think it's a great way to look at both of these games, offense versus defense, A and B team, sort of see who comes into the A team, maybe if they're playing with, you know, a different group. The goaltenders for Towson game, I think, played better than obviously the ones in the Maryland game, but I would think that the goaltenders in the Maryland game were actually the favorites going into the contest. What do you think about that?
I think that you're giving Jack Kelly a little bit too much credit by virtue of how well he played in MLL, as opposed to the idea of, you know, a seasoned, experienced veteran being a value prop. If we're starting with goalies, I think you got to ask two things. The first is, how much do you want competition at that position versus how much do you want a clear delineation between the starter and the backup? In 2010, there was a clear delineation that Brian Daugherty was the starter, and I think that there was some value in that because in 2006, you know, there was a lack of clarity in terms of that role, and I think then in 2014, when Jesse Schwartzman and Drew Adams were both, you know, competing, I don't think that there was a ton of clarity as to, you know, who was the guy going into the gold medal game, and it created some angst. And so if that's the case, I think Brian Phipps' involvement is pretty clearly pointing toward the comfort level of being a backup goaltender. And I say that primarily because he told me that. And I think I feel comfortable with that. You know, whereas my argument or my sense would be that Drew Adams and John Galloway are competing against one another to be the starter. What do you think of that theory?
I think my counterpoint to that, it's definitely plausible. My only counterpoint to that is you want a different style of that goal. Wouldn't you rather have two different style of goalie? Because Kelly and Galloway are two different styles. Drew Adams and John Galloway play a similar style of goaltending. Like they are, you know, by all accounts, sprawl and brawl, get the ball up, get the ball out. They're both amazing outletters of the ball, great stoppers. They're both great low. They're kind of all over the cage. They're great all-around goalies. It's almost like it's not butterfly stand-up for hockey terms, but I think the difference between those two and Jack Kelly is Jack Kelly comes in and he's immediately fresh, and he's a guy that has made a short, albeit short, pro career out of being a change-of-pace guy who is also capable of being a starter and plays a different style of goaltending than Galloway and Adams. And I know that this notion of having the clear starter and the backup has some validity to it, but I would rather have the best player be that second guy. And if someone is willing to do that, I would assume it's Kelly over Adams, or if you name Adams over Galloway to be the backup.
That's a good point. I want to counteract you with one specific point, which is I would favor having a righty and a lefty over having two different styles. And Adams is the only lefty in the bunch. The other three are all righties. So if you're trying to get diversity there, that to me is more important.
That's totally fair. That's the other side of that coin. But again, do you want to bring the two best guys, or do you want to bring guys that are, you know, that know their roles like concretely? For me, and we'll get to this when we get to our teams, I don't see anyone better than Galloway. Even though Galloway had the worst performance of the weekend, statistically.
Yeah, and I will say that, you know, to analyze the stats is a little bit splitting hairs because none of them saw enough shots so that their save percentage really mattered that much. Yeah, I mean, you know, I would agree in the sense that I think he's probably been the most consistent in the, you know, four intervening years since 2014. There are two additional considerations. The first, you know, he carried the water being the alternate on the 2014 team. The second is he was a volunteer assistant with John Donowski at Duke for at least one season, if not two. So there's some familiarity there and presumably a pretty good comfort level there as well.
Absolutely. I just think he's not unassailable. And I've had my fair share of criticism of Mr. Galloway. I'm sure he would love to remind people of. But, you know, it's with this group of four goalies that we're choosing from, picking two, I don't know how you go wrong. It's one of the problems with Team USA is, and we'll get to it when we pick, again, not to keep teasing that, but we're going to have different teams, but I don't think that one is going to be markedly better than another in everyone's mind, you know?
That's always been the idea, right? That the second best U.S. team would finish at least with a bronze, if not a silver, in this event. And I think that, you know, that's one of the things that chafes some people. And certainly our Canadian friends are going to be chafed by that, I'm sure. Before we move on from this goaltending, let's correlate it with the question of what type of defense do we expect this team to play? And as a result, what style of goalie play would be best behind this group of defenders?
Well, I think you definitely need a physical again, I hate to preface this by saying, well, we're building a team to beat Canada. So number one, you have to be physical, right? And number two, you have to protect the interior. And number three, you have to have guys that are great off ball. And out of those three things, the last point is the hardest one to find. And in the scrimmage that I watched, the off-ball play was, I'll say it, fairly atrocious from the Team USA defenders that were assembled there. And some guys were playing out of position. And Maryland was doing a lot of great things with ball movement and getting guys open off the ball. But you really need a defense that can communicate and lay the wood. And there are several guys in here that can do that. But I think this is the first U.S. squad that has an amazing amount of finesse and skill with the ball in transition. But my fear is that's going to be completely ignored for brute force, if that makes sense at all.
Okay, so here's an important question. You said the first thing you need is physicality. And if Canada is if Gary Gaid and John Grant are playing attack for Canada, I accept that. But if Jeremy Noble, Wes Berg, and Curtis Dixon are playing attack for Canada, is that the first thing you need? And I'm asking that question genuinely. Like, you know, and it's not just them. I mean, we've got Zach Greer in the mix, I'm sure. You know, what about some of these young guys like Jeff Teat? Like, they're not, you know. And then also, I mean, what about two of the biggest surprises of the Canadian national team tryouts? If Connor Fields and Kevin Rice play, like, you know, I would argue that if you're approaching building your Team USA defense, first and foremost, because of their physicality and their ability to push guys in the hip when they're carrying the ball and posting up, you're preparing for a Canadian team that is pretty out of date. But I want you to confirm that. Am I wrong?
Well, who was the best defender in the MLL last season?
In the MLL? In 2017?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, Joel White was the defender of the year, right?
No.
Who was?
It was Tucker Durkin.
Okay.
And Tucker Durkin is the king of all that is physical with long.
But
court.
Those two things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. Like, my point, you're picking five poles. If you're picking the best, it might end up being that he is a physical player, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're picking him because of his physicality.
It's certainly a part of why he's good, though, is my point. And I think that if you have at least one or two of those guys and the other guys that can play off the ball and have, you know, a head on a swivel the entire time and a stick on their man the entire time, and bring that first and second slide every time, that's going to be just as beneficial as a physicality. I think physicality matters. I think it does. It has to be smart. It can't be reckless. You don't want to give up a ton of penalties in international play or any other level of play for that matter. I just happen to think that on this of this roster, if we're looking at guys that are good one-on-one defenders, the majority of these guys are physical.
Okay, so one of the things about physicality that we haven't isolated or identified or really even discussed is when I think of physicality, particularly matching up against Canada, I think of a guy who's 200, 220 pounds, has a really, really solid base, doesn't necessarily throw a ton of checks, doesn't make guys feel pain, but will push a 220-pound attackman backwards when he gets to goal line extended or when he gets to 5-5. It's Sean Nadelin, it's Eric Martin, it's Brett Hughes pushing guys off their spot. And Tucker Durkin throws wood. Michael Evans used to. I'm not really sure to what degree he still does versus, you know, I know he's got that base. I know he's got that, you know, 400-pound squat, 500-pound deadlift type physical profile. But again, I don't think that's what you need against Westberg. Like, yeah, you probably are going to utilize that against Kevin Crawley. And that's actually one of the interesting things about this roster. Trey LeClair, some of the other young guys that do fit this physical profile. Chris Cloutier is probably the lone exception. Like, these guys are going to be attacking from up top. And so you kind of need more strength in terms of your guys that are running with, you know, your Dodgers from up top versus, again, you know, if it's Connor Fields, Kevin Rice, if it's Jeremy Noble, you know, even Curtis Dixon and Westberg, I think you want fast pulls that are able to match feet more than you want, you know, guys who are going to keep their feet set and push a post up back, or a guy who's going to throw a lot of checks. Because that's, you know, to your point, in terms of the penalties that we saw this weekend, you know, Scott Ratliff getting a little bit loose with his stick was, you know, that drew a slash. Like that, you know, I agree with you. The one thing you don't want to do against Canada is give him an extra man, because, you know, the reputed strength of their ball movement is going to really come to the forefront there. You know, the power to push guys off the spot comes to play, you know, guarding Jesse King and Ian McKay, I think, more than it does guarding the attackman down low.
Right, but I also think there's a healthy mixture here, right? Like I'm not saying everybody has to be a bruiser, but you need, it's almost like building a superhero team. You need the tank. You know what I mean? Like, you need the tank to be either the one or the two. And by the way, there's no shortage of options for that. And there's no shortage of options for guys that can match feet. I think a guy that maybe we don't, you know, when we get to our list, we'll talk about is Joe Fletcher, who, depending on who you talk to, you know, obviously his coach, Joe Spoleto, the Lizards, loves him, thinks he's the best defender in the MLL. Probably had his best season in his second season, not last season, but is one of the best cover guys, you know, in lacrosse. And I think you need a guy like that, as well as, you know, the finesse guys we're talking about, the power guys we're talking about, and what you really need is that communicator, right? Because even if Galloway's in the place, and Galloway's great at communicating, that's one of his strengths, as well as a goaltender. You know, you got a guy like, you got BJ Grill in here. You know, if you're running, especially if Amplo's running the defense, that's what BJ Grill does. BJ Grill screams the entire game. Like, if you're watching, I've watched several MLL games for the Outlaws, he is the voice you hear on the tape. You can hear him on the recording of the games. And that's a guy you need. You know, a guy like Liam Burns, who's also familiar with that system, that's a guy that you need. And I think the other things that come with that are the ability to organize and kind of pick your matchups. And the great variety of the pulls that are able to be selected here is, you know, do you want two LSMs? Do you want Ratliff and White? I don't know how you don't. Do you want, you know, do you have to choose between Durkin, Evans, and Manley? Or can you have all three? You know what I mean? Like, you can go a lot of different ways. And I think, you know, we'll see when we get to our list, like, how I would pick versus what you would pick versus what is probably the most plausible thing. But the combination of all three of those things is probably more important than just being physical. I would agree with that caveat that you threw in there.
One more question about the defense specifically before we move on. It's been said recently, frequently, that Joe Amplo runs a unique defensive scheme. That may be true, but if it is, like, I don't know how to describe it. I don't understand it, and I don't know how to explain it. Do you or can you?
Explain it? I think that he runs a tight and but explosive defense at the same time. So by that I mean one of the games that I saw last year that kind of stood out to me was, you know, Marquette playing in the Big East tournament. And what they would do on defense is they would kind of blow out to guys and challenge and then retreat and then kind of save the slot. And I think that by being unpredictable in when they're going to go and how hard they're going to go on the slide to a guy, or even it's not really an aggressive double, but the double is there. You know what I mean? They're a defense that's active on and off the ball. Like, everybody knows where everybody is, and I think that's why it's a good defense. I think that's why Marquette has a lot of success. So I guess the best way to describe it, I think, would be, you know, patient but devastating at the same time. And I don't know if you could say that about any Team USA defense since, what, 98? Is that mean to say? Is that bad to say?
No, I just don't know whether 98 is a
When we talk about Team USA, everyone's like, oh, man, 98. Oh,
right.
Team, right?
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. Moving on, a couple more big picture questions before we kind of dive into the I'm sure what everybody came here for that UFT is so well. Sunday was very hard to evaluate, and that was because the U.S. dominated faceoffs. There's three guys taking draws right now, two being held out due to injury. The first half of the Towson matchup, well, the injured players who are not facing off are Joe Nardella and Brendan Fowler. The first half featured Greg Renly and Tom Kelly splitting faceoffs. The second half featured Trevor Baptiste and Greg Renly splitting. I would say that they each, I believe, only lost one. My impression was that Baptiste was a cut above in terms of how easily he won and what he was capable of doing with the ball in his stick. And then there, you know, I thought Grenly was probably he was probably involved in more long tie-ups, but was clearly comfortable in that situation. Whereas, you know, I thought Kelly maybe was pushing the ball to space a little bit more quickly and running the ball down. You know, again, because of the way that they were able to dominate possession, it was difficult to glean too much from the offense or defense from Team USA. It was very easy to glean one thing from the offense, which was that Will Manny is excellent. He scored 7 goals and had an assist. And to start, was really operating a lot with Matt Kavanaugh, who was kind of playing above Gioia on the lefty wing, while Manny was floating between, you know, kind of a pure X position and also a little bit a lefty behind in a 2-2 set position. And it was really interesting because of the near side two-man games that I think folks who have watched Hofstra a lot over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years are pretty familiar with, you know, particularly what we saw out of Josh Byrne this past season. And so that's, you know, almost the extent of what I feel comfortable saying about what we saw on Sunday. Is there anything else that you saw on Saturday that you think is especially worthy of note?
I think actually, I mean, the same faceoff guys played, and I would actually have a very similar evaluation of what went down. I thought Baptiste, you know, if I was going to rank them, I think I would probably go Baptiste 1, Kelly 2, and Grenlian 3, and each one did something better than the other. And they're exactly what you said. Baptiste had an ease about him, was winning draws easily, carrying the ball on his stick, which is legal in international rules. And then Kelly winning the ball to space to himself, punching it forward. I thought he did that better than the rest. And Grenlian grinding and kind of like staying with draws that maybe the other two would have tried to stand up too quickly with, thinking they won, maybe they didn't. Or Grenlian just, you know, applying the hard work that made him Greg Grenlian to keep the ball on the ground. And I think that all three of those things are valuable, you know, in the evaluation process going forward. The problem is, I really, and you and I have talked about this, I think they're only going to take one guy. Right?
I mean, that is the perfect segue into what I wanted to talk about next, which is the roster composition. There are two things I want to talk about before we get to player specifics. Roster composition and the philosophy of, should a staff be allowed to choose guys based on their comfort level with their guys? Basically, like, is it okay to favor guys that are your guys? Let's first talk about this roster composition. I heard a rumor that there was consideration of only carrying four attackmen. That really surprised me, and if that is true, it's going to make some pretty tough choices toward keeping their guys, basically, if we decide that that's a cool thing to do. If that's the case, then the way I see the roster breaking down is four, and so this is a 23-man roster. There are a varying number of alternates based on how far removed from the event you are. I believe you're allowed to take two alternates to the event, but once you play the first game, they are not eligible to play. I'm pretty sure that's true, although maybe they're allowed to play after pool play. I'm not really totally clear on the specific rules. But I tried to build a roster with four attackmen and failed. So if I had done that, it would have been four attackmen and seven midfielders, probably with some flexibility there within. Two faceoff guys, two short stick D-middies, two LSMs, four close defensemen, and two goalies. So I would say if you're only carrying one, if you're looking at 11 offensive players, 5 and 6 or 4 and 7, and you only take one faceoff guy, then you're probably going to stick with that two short stick rotation and maybe consider adding a third, which would leave you with 6 pulls, or you would stick with two and have 7 pulls and then obviously carry two goalies. That's the way I see it. There's a difference between what would I do if I were the coach, and what's my expectation for what this staff is going to do? The majority of my expectations are uninformed. So I'm just kind of guessing on my own hunches based on, I don't know, rational thought, not necessarily based on anything else. What do you think? Do you have a really strong opinion about how a 23-man roster should be composed?
I think there's definitely a lot to be said for picking the guys that you know the best. And I think we are definitely going to see that with this group. I don't think it might be something that a lot of people talk about, but I just can't. I mean, again, I sent you my list and then I made a correction this morning. You know what I mean? Like, because I went too deep into that. Too deep into that thinking of, okay, well, they're going to pick this guy because they know this guy. But really, you have to look at what the best choice is to build a team. And one of the things that I think helps a lot of these offensive players is the ability to play more than one position and be comfortable at more than one position on the field. And to that end, there isn't a lot of slash attack mid, but there's enough, right? I mean, Joe Walters, attack slash mid. Matt Donowski, attack slash mid. Ned Crotty, attack slash mid. You know, these are guys that can play. I actually think Holman, attack slash mid, but I'm probably crazy about that.
No,
probably,
I agree. I agree with that. I absolutely agree with that.
And I think if you look at it that way, do you want versatility? Do you want, you know, one guy to run the to carry the ball or make all the decisions? Or are you comfortable with all these guys, you know, in their roles? Like, who's good off the ball?
Let me quickly jump in on that issue of the swingman. When we're talking about an attackman slash midfielder, he's a midfielder insofar as he's capable of running out of the box and likely inverting, not a guy who is going to take defensive runs and then play offense. If we're talking about that, like, really Jake Bernhardt is kind of maybe, you know, Jake Bernhardt and Matt Abbott, although Matt Abbott is such a good defensive midi that he doesn't need to be considered for his offensive skills. Those are really the only two guys that I think firmly fall into that category. You know, with respect to Karate, Janowski, Holman, you know, these are guys that you want to be essentially a fourth attackman on the field.
Sure. And that's kind of what I'm speaking to. And to your point, you know, I think actually, you know, Abbott lately, if we're going off of, you know, my knowledge of MLL, playing a lot more offense than he ever did and looking great doing it, and less defense than he ever did. Bernhardt having a great first half of the season as the third midfielder due to injuries. You know, guys like Kyle Harrison were out for the machine. on that championship squad, stepping up when needed. I think that's, you know, I know we're not totally using the MLL as a metric here, but I want to make a case for it to be included, because if you're looking, if you're trying to make a decision on a guy and he's up against a guy who, you know, obviously, like, you have guys like MVPs on this team all over the place, you know, Paul Rabil, Tom Schreiber. I feel like those guys are kind of no-brainers on the team just because of what they can do and the explosive nature of their play. But if you're, we're talking about making the decision on maybe the fourth or fifth attackman. And if you're looking at tape, the tape is there to help you make the decision between that guy. And that tape comes from the MLL. And I think guys like, you know, Holman have an advantage there.
So you are an advocate for shading, you know, if it's picking between one or two guys, you think it is wiser for this staff to pick based on MLL performance more so than their performance at US team events in July, September, and October?
I think it should be definitely considered because it's a more complete body of work.
I don't think that that's a bad argument. I just think it is a polarizing argument. I think that there are some people who would firmly disagree with it on the basis of the notion that, well, if that's the case, why even have tryouts? And there is actually some thinking that way. I mean, there's some very obvious reasons why have tryouts. But yeah, I mean, I don't have a strong opinion on it. Primarily because I think the 2010 staff took MLL very seriously and utilized it as a source of information that helped them win the world championship. And so I would be loath to dismiss out of hand the value of that. That being said, from a ethical morality standpoint, I would favor choosing players based on their performance on the tryout U.S. playing field, because it's more fair, and also because the criteria might be a little bit more closely ascribed to what skill sets are necessary in order to win a gold medal, that being playing under international rules.
I will say that, kind of taking it into a kind of a little bit of a darker place, no, watching the MLL all summer and then seeing that first list of cuts, nothing surprised me.
Based on the way those guys who had gotten cut played in MLL?
Yes.
Yeah, I got you. I want to weigh in on the how much should, because my expectation is that, you know, the 23-5-7 man roster is going to come out and people are going to lose their minds about some guys who got cut and some guys who made it, in the same way that people lost their minds when Matt Zash and Kevin Cassis and Chris Schiller made it in 2010. And I dispute that notion out of hand. I think that, you know, while a player's legacy is on the line relative to his U.S. national team inclusion, a coach's is more so, because there are 23 guys on a team and there's one head coach. And that head coach has the responsibility to win. And if you are going to straddle him with that responsibility, you need to give him the leeway to choose his own guys. And his guys are his guys, regardless of the reason that they're his guys. Like, for example, it could be because he believes a certain athletic profile is best served to win lacrosse games. It could be because we're going to play a specific style that I have coached previously, and there's value in the head start that players who have played for me have already had. You know, on and on it goes. I think that, you know, I just, you know, when people criticize coaches for choosing their own, you know, players with whom they're familiar and with whom they have long history, I understand the argument. I just don't agree with it.
Well, also, I would love to make that argument if the players we're talking about aren't like Jordan Wolf and Miles Jones.
Exactly, if they aren't themselves great.
Right. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen in the instance of there might be one of those guys or two of those guys. And you're like, okay, that's an Amplo pick. Okay, it's a Dowski pick. Who cares? There's still everybody on this roster deserves to be where they are. And I think that, you know, like I said, I think that the cuts that were made did not surprise me. And also, I did see one of those, like, key tryout dates. And also, after those tryouts, like, There were some guys that were like, "Oh, I don't get why that guy was cut." I was like, "I watched the trial. I know why he was cut." You know, it's being there. It's evaluating them from what they can do and what they show you versus what you know they're capable of. And in that instance, I think a lot of these coaches have an advantage, and I think people should probably get off their back.
It's another instance of the idea of the term body of work. You know, body of work is a phrase that we hear all the time around NCAA selection. And it's kind of political cover for it's too complicated to explain in this scenario. There were too many factors, variables, so many factors and variables that we might not have applied them consistently across the entire field. But the je ne sais quoi of the choices that we made is how we came to this decision. And I don't want to explain it to you in this setting. But I think that that's what humans do when you make decisions. So let's move on. We only have a little bit of time left. Let's talk about the attack. Like I said, I tried to make it four guys. I ended up making it five. I believe you did the same. Why don't you go first, and then I will isolate my different choices.
All right. Starting with the attack, my first name on the sheet is Jordan Wolf. And Jordan Wolf did something in the Maryland scrimmage that was interesting. He played off ball a lot, and that's not what he does in the MLL for sure. A huge part of that Rochester offense, dodging off the catch, and you know Tim Sudan, the coach of the Rattlers, talked a lot about resting him and giving him reps. It's not going to be a problem on Team USA. He's going to be fresh, so he's number one on my team sheet. And then I think Rob Pinnell has really surprised me during this tryout process. I don't think he had I thought he had a good year this summer in the MLL, but seeing him play in Team USA practices and evaluation periods, he's been amazing. He's really been a very multifaceted player with the ball and off the ball. Marcus Holman is my third. I just think that he does so many things well. You can't not have him. And my next two picks are probably going to be like, what are you talking about? But I'm comfortable with him. Ryan Brown, because shoot or shoot, and you need a guy that can stick the ball in a corner sometimes in games to win the game and have that big shooter with the big confidence, can finish with both hands, great on the crease, great off the ball, and kind of a sneaky ample guy because he's an assistant there at Marquette. And then, you know, my fifth guy is Matt Tanasky. I just think there's no way – he's played well, guys. You know, you can say whatever you want, but he's played really well in these evaluation periods for Team USA. He is – it's funny because, like, I've always said that Danowski kind of made a switch when he went pro from when he was in college to from being, like, the facilitator and the dodger and the guy who sets up other people to being the guy. And that has varying degrees of success, but I think he's been very successful this summer, so he's my fifth guy.
So I'm with you out of four of those five picks. In place of Ryan Brown, I'm going with Will Manny. And the logic is very similar to yours. Shoot or shoot. Will Manny is not necessarily a shooter in that regard, but he is a specialist in the sense that he's the lefty. Not to say that he's the only lefty in the group, and a couple of these guys can play on the left side. I think Will Manny is the best at playing the left-handed attack spot. And I think that in Seth Tierney's offense, that has value. I totally agree with you about Ryan Brown, and it's going to be interesting because when we get to the midfielders, you're going to see why I think they don't necessarily need a shooter from that right-handed position. But to me, your including Ryan Brown was similar to Drew Westervelt's inclusion in the 2010 roster, and I thought that that was great. I thought that was a no-brainer. I thought he was really valuable for that team, and so I'm conflicted when I find myself arguing against the need for a right-handed shooter. But like I said, I do think it comes a little bit later when we talk about the midfield. The one thing about this composition that we both just proposed is that it doesn't include a bona fide no-brainer crease roamer. And coming away from the 2006 World Championships, that was like talked about as a huge need or point of emphasis, and Kevin Lavelle filled that role, not really, but sort of as an alternate in 10, and then made the team in 14. I don't hear anybody talking about the need to have a crease guy on this team, nor do I really see an obvious candidate. So what do you think about the concept of a crease attackman relative to the composition of this group?
I think Holman can do it. And I think that's the choice if we're picking these five. I think he's the guy. He flashes down the middle all day for the Machine. And honestly, in the trial process, the guy that surprised me with his ability to do that as well, that we both named, was Pennell. And also, I mean, I know when we say crease finisher, we're kind of thinking of just a guy that can finish in tight. I mean, let's be honest. All these guys can finish in tight. It's just a matter of catch and finish in tight. And I think Holman is that guy, if we're talking, you know, around the crease kind of roamer, with the ability to play everywhere else on the field, obviously. But
I think more than anything else, what we're talking about, and it's not even what we're talking about right now, and I think it speaks more to the way the teams are playing defense. But when we're talking about a crease guy in general, it's not about the skill set of being able to catch and finish. It's about the fact that you cannot slide from him, and he's going to be on the crease all the time. And I don't think that, like, you know, there was a heyday for that around the turn of the decade. You know, and I think Matt Paske was probably the, at one point, best young player. And then, you know, I think that there was some belief going into 14 that Chris Bocklet was going to fill that role and take that mantle. But would you even say in MLL that that's kind of a bona fide role anymore?
No, it's so a lot of guys start on the crease and fade. And the guy that I named that does that better than anyone else, I think, on this list that we can choose from is Ryan Brown. And that's why he's on my pick, because he does float to the opposite side of the ball. Lefty dodger, righty dodger, doesn't matter. He does kind of start on the crease and kind of pull his guy out, see where he's going. He's not much of a carrier per se, but his ability to kind of bring his man inside and be respected for his ability to shoot and finish, you know, and I think Holman is very similar as well. He'll float in and out. And I think it's more of a guy who starts there but doesn't finish there. And that's depending on whatever offense they're running. And let me tell you, Team USA used a lot of off-ball movement and off-ball picks to get guys open against Maryland. And I think all these guys can kind of fit that build. It's a skill set that – it's funny. We talk about evaluating players all the time. Talk about MLL, international play, all that stuff. We forget sometimes that players can do anything. We just ascribe them these positions of, oh, he's a shooter. Oh, he's a passer. Oh, he's a facilitator. It doesn't mean they can't do the other things.
I know, but there's a difference between being able to do them and being so used to doing them that your habits allow you to consistently perform them at a world-class level, which is what this stage requires.
Sure, and to that point, this is why Brown is on my team. He's a world-class shooter. And he's a world-class off-ball player.
So I want to make an argument. We're going to transition to midfielders here. That the guy who is – I'm just going to come on and say it. I think Paul Rabil is going to fill a shooter, slasher, cutter, catch one cradle finisher for this team in a way that is going to surprise some people. I think that the primary initiators – and I don't think they're going to run on the same line because they didn't play on the same team this past weekend. I think the primary initiators on the first and second line are going to be Tom Schreiber and Miles Jones. And I think the group is going to be rounded out by Joe Walters, Drew Snyder, and Connor Busick.
So I don't disagree with that first point at all. And Rabil has transitioned since he's been kind of on the Lizard, since he got traded, to being a complimentary cutter player as well as kind of secondary initiator. And people might be surprised to hear me say that, but if you watch MLL, you know that's true. And he, by the way, he's good at it.
And he's talked about how it's been an intentional choice. I mean, obviously his health issues have probably accelerated that at a rate that, you know, he would have preferred not to see happen. That being said, to your point, he's good at it. And to a point that I want to make, like, it's the type of thing that, like, that versatility makes you way more valuable to your team, regardless of what team it is, and it extends your career. And, you know, I would tip my cap to him because it's not easy, right? Like, you know, it's kind of – the analogy that I would make is that Kobe Bryant late in his career was a good enough three-point shooter that he probably could have played five more years just as a spot-up shooter in the corner, but he was clear in his unwillingness to do so. If I were him, I wouldn't have made that choice. I would have said, no, I want to play. I want to be a part of teams. I want to, you know, I think Tim Duncan was someone who did make that choice. You know, he transitioned from being a focal point of the offense to, in the last couple of years with the Spurs, really being a additive force as, you know, a hands-up, verticality, defensive-first player. And I find that to be really interesting, and I think that, you know, it would be aggressive to say that Rabel has, you know, really relinquished too much of his alley-dodging, offense-creating, slide-drawing style. But I think that he's going to be a complement to Schreiber and or Jones. And I think he's going to bring a lot to the table when he's on the field doing the other stuff that we talked about. And I think that, you know, Connor Bucic fits that role really, really well. And then I think Snyder and Walters each provide a multitude of assets. Walters, his left-handedness. Snyder, his versatility of this group of five. You know, he's probably the one that, or this group of six middies, he's probably the one that I would be most interested in seeing get caught back on defense. But how does my group deviate from yours?
There's only one deviation, and it's Walters. And it's kind of funny because we did talk about this yesterday before we started doing the pod. And I picked a guy that's, you know, that I didn't think I was going to pick. And I went through the list and I was like, this is the only guy that makes sense. It makes sense. And that's John Hawes instead of Walters. And it has nothing to do with Walters' ability or Hawes' ability. It's more the versatility of what Hawes brings versus what Walters brings. And it doesn't mean that what Walters brings isn't valuable, because being a lefty, slipping under guys, and kind of, you know, being a facilitator as well as a great shooter is obviously valuable. I just don't think Team USA wants guys that can, you know, get to multiple positions. And the thing about Walters is Walters loves like three spots on the field, period. He doesn't like to go all over the field, and that's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. I just think that this coaching staff would rather have somebody that they think they can coach to go wherever they want, and have that guy put out, you know, be able to go to different places and have an output, even if he's just a hinge for the next pass. That Hawes is that guy. It's a safer pick for me. Like, yours is more logical. Mine is just I'm gonna be safe because I know Hawes can do all sorts of things. It's just like the argument for having, you know, guys like Holman and Donowski. I know what they can do. They can do all sorts of different things. And that means the more versatility you have, the more places you can play on the field, and the more ways the coaching staff can use you.
Let's move on to the rest of the midfield group. You mentioned carrying only one faceoff specialist. It is Trevor Baptiste. I think that this team will carry two. So I think that Greg Grenlian will join Trevor Baptiste at the faceoff dot. And I think that the short stick D-middies will be Matt Abbott and Will Hawes.
Okay, I went with Bernhardt. I went with Abbott as well and Baptiste. I did not pick a second faceoff guy. I just don't think they're going to. I think they should. And for me, it probably is Grenlian, but I don't want to discount the work that Tommy Kelly has done. And this is, again, my argument for, hey, MLO body of work. Do put on clinics for most of the summer when he wasn't hurt. He got hurt in the All-Star game when everyone else went to go try out for Team USA.
I was going to talk. I talked about that on Sunday with the guy I was standing with watching the game, and just how cool it is to see him on this field now because of how upset he was when he realized that he had been injured in the All-Star game and it was going to prevent him from being a part of the U.S. team tryout.
Well, it's a testament to his ability that he's still here and his ability to bounce back. I mean, no one knew who Tommy Kelly was until he went in the MLL. You know, like that. That's why, you know, people wonder, like, why does it matter? Like, why do you watch that? It's not even like good. First of all, it is good. You're wrong. And it matters because of stuff like this. You know, it gives guys a chance to make Team USA.
you know, for me, the poster child for that is Brendan Mundorf. He played for the Australian national team in 2006 and then was a keystone, cornerstone of the 2010 and 14 U.S. teams. Let's move on to the polls. You have 7. I have 6. I think the long 6 are going to be Scott Ratliff and Liam Burns.
I have Ratliff and White because I don't think you leave a talent like Joel White at home.
But you also have Liam Burns. You just have him as a close defenseman.
That's correct, because I think that he can play down there, especially in this system. And another guy I have down low, BJ Grill. I think they play well together, obviously, because of their time at Marquette and their understanding of the defense that Ample's going to run is going to be better than anybody else that's available. And, again, to round out my polls, I guess, I have Tucker Durkin, Mike Evans, Liam Burns, Joe Fletcher, and BJ Grill.
And so the only place that we diverge, I do not have Joel White. Instead, I have the second faceoff guy. And I do not have Joe Fletcher. Instead, I have Mike Manley. I think Mike Manley provides two things: familiarity with Duke, to whatever degree that matters. And the second thing is indoor experience. And then the third thing, I'm kind of contradicting myself. You know, he brings some of that meat and physicality to complement Evans and Durkin should that become an issue. I guess I would also add that, you know, in to a degree this is true for all these guys, but the ability to play up top if necessary, we've seen that out of Joe Fletcher. I want to – this conversation, you know, let's spend a minute talking about Mike Manley and Joe Fletcher, or I want to hear you spend a minute talking about those two, because I noticed what you mentioned earlier, which is that – it didn't seem like Joe Fletcher's 2017 MLS season was as highly regarded as his 2016 year, and I wonder why that is, what that means. Is it more a function of the Lizards' performance in the standings and how you've seen that translate into this tryout on-field evaluation time for the U.S. team?
I think it has a lot to do with the people he was playing defense with on the Lizards, because that was a lot of a rotating cast at times. And, you know, guys like Kyle Sweeney, who retired after the season, it made Fletcher, people want to go at Fletcher more frequently for some reason. And I think that you saw him make a little bit more mistakes than you're probably used to seeing because there wasn't help. And I think that probably made him look worse than he was. I thought he's still a great defender. I want him on the USA team. I think he deserves it. But I think that, And I think he can guard anybody on Team Canada. Like, he can guard Kevin Rice. Like, trust me, he can. I don't know how anyone's going to perform against Fields. Like, Fields could just go Super Saiyan and, like, drop 10 goals. We never know. But I think, you know, a guy like that versus a guy like Manley hasn't been healthy for a very long time. And I don't know what I'm getting with Manley versus Fletcher. I know what Fletcher can do, and I know that Fletcher is going to be in shape and not care about carrying the ball across the field. I think Manley will probably be in shape too due to his other job with state police, but I know he's going to want to carry that ball over the half line too. So I don't know what that value is. I don't know what that, if that helps valuation or not. And I think, you know, you already have a guy like Manley and Evans, who, by the way, kind of has the same problems of staying healthy. So I think we're going to see, I don't know, even if they name all these defensemen, there's some serious health problems with a lot of these guys that we don't know who's going to make it to World Games.
I don't know how many of these guys are going to play MLL if they do make it.
That's an interesting point. Again, MLL under siege, okay? We're under siege here. We're in a bunker. We're looking for a new commissioner. All of our information's in the public. What are we going to do? You know, so that's a plausible thing. And that would be a shame because I think all the fans want to see these guys play on their MLL teams. But I think also, as you saw with the All-Star game, there wasn't a ton of fallout from that, from the fans. There was a little bit, but not a lot, because guys legit forgot about the All-Star game, got named to the team, didn't say anything on social media, left, and went to the Team USA tryout instead. And then all these randos showed up to the All-Star game. So, I mean, obviously Team USA is a priority for a lot of these guys, and that's great because it means a lot to them. That helps the World Games. It does not help the MLL. But this isn't an MLL podcast. Team USA podcast.
Well, I mean, it's not that different from Greg Grenland having already retired but remaining in the player pool for Team USA. I'm speaking specifically about Manly and Evans.
Yeah.
By the way, you know how crazy it is? Mike Evans never won an MLL Defensive Player of the Year.
Never?
What's more, what is crazier, Brody Merrill winning five in a row or Mike Evans never winning one?
Oh, man. Why are you doing that? You know that's going to get me in trouble.
Because he was the funniest MLL podcast guest of the year, and I just want to see whether or not he's going to make it this far into this podcast.
I'm going the other way. I don't think that Brody should have had all five. I think Evans deserved at least one, for sure.
All right, let's bring this in for landing. We're going to talk about goalies. We already talked about it, basically, so now we're just going to make a decision and go on the record with which one we think we're right. And by the way, we never really clarified, like, are these teams, like, who we think are going to get picked? Because that's more or less, you know, really with the exception, I think, of Busek and Manny, I was picking with, these are the guys I think are going to get selected. And with Busek and Manny, it was like, I think these guys should make it. Partly because of the way they performed in the tryouts, and also partly because I think they will help the team.
I would go 80-20. 80% we think they're going to make it. 20% like, you know, this guy should make it.
It's kind of like how we rank teams in the preseason. You know what I mean? It's like 80% how good we think they're going to be. No, 80% how good they are on paper right now, 20% how good we think they're going to be, if that makes any sense. But in any case, I think it's going to be Drew Adams and John Galloway. Righty lefty.
Yeah. No, and that's a good point. We kind of already talked about this. I definitely think Galloway, Kelly, just for a change of style and you know, both of their ability to get the ball out. And, you know, not for nothing, Jack Kelly did score a goal. 95.
That's literally 4-0.
I know. It's 4-0. You're right.
Well, the U.S. team was not the only team in action this past weekend. Team Canada scrimmaged a trio of NCAA programs in advance of their Thanksgiving holiday. The Iroquois national team in action the weekend prior, scrimmaging Albany. A lot going on. We will continue to monitor this as we go forward. One of the things that is a caveat here also, I don't know when what we just discussed is going to be announced. Like, it's very reasonable that we just spent 50 minutes talking about something that's not going to provide any clarity with until like early February. But either way, it was fun. I enjoyed it, Kyle. One quick thought on Maryland.
Dude, Maryland looks good. Bubba Fairman's good. You know, it's not rocket science out there. They have good players. You know, will they miss Rambo and Heacock? Sure. But they have great Dodgers. Connor Kelly's legit. They're a legitimate team, despite any of my suggestions to the latter, just to make Dan Abern upset during our podcast last season.
To that end, Towson, a team that obviously didn't perform quite as well as they would have liked against the U.S. national team. I think they're going to be fine. I have a hard time imagining Alex Woodall struggling that badly during the regular season. They're certainly a team that's going to be built from the defensive end, and I think you know, that is pretty typical, pretty in line with how Towson wants to build. I was most impressed by Zach Goodrich, the junior short stick D-Mitty, who really emerged on the scene last season. And I was really impressed by junior midfielder John Mazza. I thought, you know, Goodrich, we know about his physicality and his physical tools, but I think he also added a lot or showed a lot in terms of confidence and mentality. You know, Mazza really, really impressed me with his physicality. A couple new pieces to the offense. I think Brody McLean's going to bring a lot of heat from the left side, the Stony Brook transfer. I think the Maryland transfer, Timmy Monahan, is going to provide a nice spark to the right-handed attack spot. I think that defense is going to be backlined by Shane Brennan, a redshirt freshman, right-handed player. I think he looked good in goal, and I think that, you know, Towson's going to be a team that has a lot of work to do. I just think they're going to do it, and they're going to be not who they were in 2017 and probably not who they were in 2016, but exactly who they were from 2013 to 15, based on, you know, the reputation and the continuity of that coaching staff.
Love those CAA teams.
Kyle, this has been great. Really enjoyed it. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. If you liked what you heard, or even if you didn't, feel free to leave a rating and a review. We appreciate it. We love constructive criticism. And if you want to hear more, check back on Friday as we will return with the Inside Lacrosse Recruiting Podcast. And then, Kyle, you're about to get fired up, huh?
Yeah, we're going to bring a new lacrosse industry podcast. I'm going to bring some people on that, you know, I have past relationships with that work in the industry, and I think there's a lot of interest for people. You know, how do you get a job in lacrosse? What do you do in lacrosse? You know, we'll have coaches on, we'll have people that work for companies, we'll have people that, you know, found a new way to get into the industry and make a living. It's going to be really exciting, and we're going to launch that next week. Pretty excited.
All right, once again, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on Friday.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.